So, welcome and to all of you. All of you have met Carola individually, just very briefly for some of you who didn't quite know. Carola is in fact a Canadian citizen and lives here, but she has traveled quite a bit internationally. She was a judge in Frankfurt in Germany, and some of you, I just discovered this yesterday, in Germany, everybody who becomes a lawyer also trains as a judge so that they know this is the evidence the judge will consider. You know, so regardless of how now your brief are, only these points count. And then if you're bright, you actually become a judge and the others, you know, whatever. So Carola belongs to that category.
Thank you.
But she has been very interested also in the issue of religious freedom. She has traveled internationally, lived internationally, Australia, and just this last summer, was in Strasbourg at the Ecumenical Institute, and then later on was at the Bonhoeffer Conference in Prague. So the international issues around how do you deal with faith traditions, how do you deal with creed, and how do you deal with the constitutions of a country, which basically all liberal democratic Western societies have to deal with, is an issue of concern. So we welcome Carola and
thank you.
Hold forth, and then just to alert you, when some people say it isn't that they are that shocked by what you're saying, maybe they are, but they'll tell you that privately. Some people have to get hepatitis B shots, and others have classes, so this is always a funny time.
Before I start, there's a handout on half for everyone. You're welcome to take one.
Kim Fordham. From CASA? No, but she teaches in CASA. And Barry Ball.
Hi.
Thank you. From Camrose. Okay. I'll just take a few of them.
Well, before I start with my talk, I would like to thank the Chester Ronick Center, and in particular David Goa and Dietmar Müller, for inviting me to talk to you today. It's a privilege and honor to have this opportunity. I will first engage the topic between creed and constitution, freedom of religion in Germany, from a legal historical and then from a cultural perspective. This will be followed by a review of the Islamic headscarf case and German-Turkish relational initiatives within the current constitutional system of Germany. Please hold your questions. There will be time at the end to ask them and hopefully to answer them. In April 1940, during World War II, Willem Wissert-Hoff, the Secretary General-elect of the newly formed World Council of Churches, wrote in a letter to colleagues in England and the US in which he described Nazism and communism as anti-Christian forces determined to wipe out Christianity altogether. He wrote, "In this situation, the Church dare not concentrate its main attention on what are commonly called peace aims, but must rather confront in a wholly new manner that hardest of all tasks which it has faced since the times of the Middle Ages, namely the reconversion of most of the Western world. This is a tremendous spiritual and missionary task, rather than a task of technical and political character." But contrary to this, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor and professor of theology at the University of Berlin, envisioned in 1941 a post-war secular and pluralist society in Germany with a generally emancipated worldly church and mutually recognized and balanced limits for the state-church relation. So whose vision unfolded in post-war Germany? I'll start with the constitutional history at this point. After heated deliberations within the Parliamentary Council of 1948 and 49, the representatives of the political parties, the Catholic Church and the Evangelical Church of Germany, which is the Protestant Church of Lutheran Calvinist heritage, you all know, between these three groups, the new German constitution, the Basic Law, was accepted. Within the 1949 constitution, this Basic Law, freedom of faith, religion, conscience, and the right to profess a religious or non-religious worldview confession, including their practice, as well as the freedom to assemble in groups and organizations, are guaranteed. Also guaranteed is state-supervised education, which includes religious instructions that are organized in coordination with the religious institutions, while the parents have the right to decide about their children's attendance. The rights to religious freedom, assembly, and education are part of the Human and Civil Rights Catalog at the beginning of the Basic Law, where they enjoy particular protection. The catalog is binding for the state powers, for all three state powers, the legislature, executive, and judiciary, as unmediated, directly applicable law. That means any person who feels violated in any one or more of the basic rights has guaranteed direct access to the German courts, including the Constitutional Court. And an additional safety net is given in the so-called Eternity Guarantee. Amendments to this catalog are inadmissible. They are, so to say, untouchable. The Constitution prescribes further that there is no state church, and all religious and worldview societies have equal access to a public law status, which is connected to financial state support. This no state church prescription and the public law opportunity are regulations of the 1919 Weimar Constitution, which are accepted as immediate parts of the basic of the current basic law and appear in the main body of the Constitution. So why do religious freedom and religious education enjoy a particular protection? And why could regulations of an earlier constitution find their way almost unaltered into the 1949 Basic Law? Well, during the 19th century Germany, the idea of a secular state wrestled with the idea of a Christian state. Catholicism discovered that the liberal bourgeois and political demands for freedom rights offered to the church the possibility to replace the customary ties of the church to the monarchic state with an independent church safeguarded by basic constitutional guarantees. Catholic representatives to the Constitutional Assembly in Frankfurt in the wake of the 1848 March Revolution seemed to have accomplished their political Catholic program when no state church was proclaimed. Also, freedom of faith and confession, the right to freely assemble and to found associations were to be claimable individual rights and immediately binding for the state powers. But the Frankfurt Paulskirchen Constitution, as it is known, proved to be way ahead of its time. Instead of coming into effect, it took a 100-year detour through a Kulturkampf, which is in English culture fight or culture war, another revolution, and a totalitarian dictatorship. The detour began with Bismarck's Kulturkampf in the 1870s, which he waged against the political Catholicism of the Parliamentary Center Party. The Center Party, whose influence cut across class and provincial lines, had become the strongest party in the parliament of the newly established German Reich of 1871. Bismarck, a pietist, Lutheran, Prussian conservative statesman, was convinced that the center's party spirit stood in allegiance to an authority in Rome, which was foreign to the parliamentary German state, that it was a state within a state. His conviction was also fueled by the recently proclaimed papal ban curse, which condemned 80 liberal errors, like individual religious freedom, state-regulated schools, and state religions other than Catholicism. He was also cited by the Vatican's declaration of the dogma of papal infallibility and the dogma of primal jurisdiction of the Pope, which guaranteed a so far unknown absolute and worldwide power for the Pope. Bismarck intended to subdue the influence of the Catholic Church within society in general, and thus the parliamentary influence of the center party, by attacking the Catholic Church's involvement in the educational system in particular. He submitted church-operated schools to state supervision, banned Catholic priests from office in public schools, monitored clergy education and employment, omitted the financial support, state support for Roman Catholic episcopates and clerics, inserted the pulpit paragraph into the criminal code, which prohibited clerics to discuss politics from the pulpit, and much more. But the culture war was clearly lost, as instead of weakening or even destructing the Catholic Center Party's parliamentary influence, the party gained strength in subsequent elections. However, the culture war has left a permanent legacy. The requirement for the churches to respect state law, state-supervised schools and universities, the civil wedding, and the reduction of ecclesiastic worldly jurisdiction. In contrast, the Protestant Church, true to its Reformation tradition, had remained during the 19th century in close relation to the state. The sovereign of the territory had a summus episcopalis, also dominion over the external ecclesiastic affairs and the internal affairs of dogma and liturgy of the Protestant Church. After World War I and the monarchy-ending revolution of 1918, the radical socialist communist left immediately proceeded to install a republican state church by attacking the position of both the Catholic and the Protestant churches within society. In this situation, the moderate Socialist Democratic Party and the Catholic Center Party reached with the 1919 Weimar Constitution an amazing culture compromise. The declaration that there was to be no state church brought the millennial cut of a prohibition to reintroduce any legal forms of a state church system. Thus it provided the normative fact of the end of the Christian state. It was the legal end of the bond between throne and altar. This radical separation would have meant to reduce the Protestant churches to the private civil law level. This blow, though, was softened with a status under corporate public law, a status which was attached to self-determined internal legislative powers, the applicability of favorable taxation laws, exemption from employment laws, protection from expropriation, financial support for church buildings, and more. In this limping separation, this limping secularity, the freedom and independence of all involved is balanced with an equal offer to all religious societies to receive corporate public law status with its state-backed financial opportunities. This actually provided the lifeline for the Protestant Church. The Protestant Church, by gaining the legal autonomy to ecclesiastic self-determination in all external and internal affairs, had lost at the same time, through its separation from the state apparatus, its whole financial base. In its mindset, though, the Protestant Church remained in close proximity to the state until the 1940s. Then the National Socialists attacked both major churches by targeting, again, religious education, confessional schools, theological faculties, and the church's financial order and public law status. Their purpose was to depoliticize the churches and to deconfessionalize public life. The Protestant Church became, by way of the German Christians, almost a Reich Church, but recalling in the church struggle of the confessing church their nature, the Protestant Church finally realized the necessity to accept an attitude of independent responsibility. During the past two centuries, two extremes, a Christian extreme and a political extreme, had triggered wars, a culture war and a military war. Both extremes used education and church finances as fronts in the battle between faith and politics. By 1949, both churches had finally gained institutional independence and the inner strength to approach the state, genuinely emancipated with the consciousness of independence and self-reliance. But also, the state had gained a distance towards organized religious worldviews. The combined learnings of all parties involved through centuries of war and revolutions has produced with a basic law a secular system which generally emancipated worldly churches, thus acknowledging Bonhoeffer's vision. protected are today the hard-fought for basic right to profess or to abstain from professing a religious or non-religious worldview confession, affordable state-supervised and funded education with religious components in curriculum, cooperation with all relevant religious institutions, and a state-backed corporate public law opportunity. In full knowledge of the radical institutional separation existing in the US, France, and the Soviet Union, the Parliamentary Council of 1949 opted with a great majority for this historically grown pluralist and balanced limping secularity. A separation in attitude and institutional organization, but with regulated continued cooperation instead of a radical separation with exceptions. This systematic framework is most clearly characterized by three principles drawn from the constitutional text: the principle of parity, non-identification, and neutrality. According to the principle of parity and the basic right of equality before the law, the state is required not to privilege but to equally respect all religious or non-religious worldview organizations, although differentiations are possible if they are based on non-faith evaluating objective, material, and verifiable criteria, which all organizations can and have to fulfill equally. This is an assessment not of their faith, but of their behavior according to worldly criteria. The principle of non-identification prohibits the secular state to maintain any formal connections to a particular confession, religion, or non-religious worldview, thus providing to its citizens the space to practice their individual freedom of religious or worldview choice. The state is only permitted and required to guard its own identity by upholding the core nature of its constitutional framework and the legal peace. Finally, the principle of neutrality obliges the state to keep its independence by remaining non-judgmental and non-committed to all religions and worldviews within its borders. This is for the purpose of preserving for the citizens the opportunity to either express or refrain from revealing their views in the public space. To use adherence to a particular religion or worldview conviction as criteria for awarding individual advantages or transferring disadvantages, for the enjoyment of civil and political rights, and for eligibility to public office is specifically prohibited. I come now to the second part, the cultural paradigm shift. While the events of the 19th century were of commanding guidance for the constitutional realities of the mid and late 20th century, so have the horrific experiences of the first half of the 20th century led to a paradigm shift in the understanding of culture within the post-war German society. The cultural changes occurred in four developmental stages, which I would describe roughly as survival mode, PTS syndrome, analysis, and action. At the end of World War II, in 1945, Germany's population had reached rock bottom, physically, socially, emotionally, and culturally, which was followed by a few years of pure survival mode, in which the remaining population literally had to dig themselves out of the rubble to find shelter and food. What would today be diagnosed in individuals as PTS, post-traumatic stress syndrome, prevented a whole nation from immediately confronting the question which seemed to the rest of the world so obviously necessary to be addressed. Apart from the international political developments of the first half of the 20th century, which had its own dynamics, the most pressing question was, how could it happen that a people with a rich history of intellectual accomplishments could err so badly and be seduced to commit such inhumane acts in the name of patriotism and nationalism to people of another ethnic and religious group? Having to overcome deep shock, followed by only slowly regaining a general sense of being, the analytical and processing stage was reached and in full swing by the 1960s. Today, this analysis is still ongoing, but has reached a new dimension by incorporating generational studies. As living memory is about to disappear due to the age factor, the emphasis has turned today to the question of how to preserve memory, not as an unhealthy inherited guilt experience, but rather in the form of permanent learning to prevent similar catastrophic events in future generations within Germany and potentially also in other places of the world. By the late 1970s, the last and also still today continuing stage of action was introduced with Chancellor Willy Brandt's historic public and international acknowledgement of Germany's wrongdoing. At the height of the Cold War, and against the opposition of even his own party, he opened up the conversation with the East. By the 1980s, this change of direction to reconciliation and to overcoming animosities and hate developed into a full-blown peace movement that was greatly supported by the two major churches, with activities like the Easter marches. This was finally bearing fruits in 1989, more than 40 years after the war, when millions walked out of yet another oppressive system, East Germany, to bring about peaceful revolution, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification, the end of military occupation, and a peace agreement with the Allied forces. Parallel to the dynamics of overcoming the East-West Cold War dichotomy, a French-German idea, originally brought forward as Pan-European movement in 1923, gained momentum in the post-World War II era for the purpose of escaping extreme forms of nationalism. Realizing that the underlying reasons for most of the European wars were of economic and food distribution nature, with a strong North-South dichotomy, the rich North and the poor South, the European Economic Community was founded by six states with the 1957 Treaty of Rome, which aimed at economic integration. Out of these beginnings, the political and economic European Union has developed and was formally established with the 1993 Maastricht Treaty. It's now 27 member states, include today many of those that were formerly behind the Eastern Iron Curtain. The European Union guarantees the freedom of movement of people, goods, services and capital, has a common currency, has developed a limited role in foreign policy, and has its legislative, executive and judicative institutions. With Turkey's application to join, the European Union has reached a new dimension in European, Asian and East-West relations and dialogue. The cultural paradigm shift, which happened within and through the just summarized developments of the second half of the 20th century, found philosophic expressions in Germany and Europe in the advancing move from phenomenology and existentialism to critical and communicative theory, and in Christian theology, from political theology to theology after Auschwitz, and now to communicative and public theology. Conflict between cultures can occur only if they are understood as separate units, similar to personal self-identities, defined by origin, religion, language, customs, values, and traditional institutions. But a closer look reveals that societal cultures are not homogeneous single units. Instead, their internal fabric consists of many internal differences. Decisive becomes, therefore, the way their internal frictions are communicated, received, interacted with, and how a culture accommodates outer perceptions. In particular, religious conflicts are often based on tensions which are generated by conflict-oriented representation of the other unknown religious form. Then education and intercultural context can turn exotic fascination, hate or fear into reciprocal understanding. Overcoming the misuse of religion for religious mythical legitimization of ethnic national identity and pureness of a country and its people, the 1949 German Basic Law opted for and ever since actively pursues a system which views humanity as a cultural whole, defined by worldviews and ecological human needs, which are basic to all cultural ideas. Origin is not any longer understood in a backward genealogical view as belonging to a particular group opposed to another group, but with a forward-looking perspective to generational developments. Cultural matters and their connected policies are foremost the responsibilities of the individual European Union member states, although since the Maastricht Treaty, cultural cooperation has also become a community competency. The concept of the German Constitution, with its protected freedoms and education, as well as the supportive state-backed public law opportunities, are a blanket or tent-like worldly legal cover, which expresses the constitutional expectation of the state that all religious and non-religious worldviews and their permanent societies are of importance in the overall development of society. Strengthening their separate and independent status respects and protects their contribution to the public order and recognizes that their spiritual domain reaches further than the socio-political sphere. Within the public sphere, as a constitutionally protected forum, every individual or group can compete or campaign for memberships, adherence to religious faith, and for political votes. The text of the Basic Law does not support an unwritten, between-the-lines discernible Western culture proviso, which would transfer a legal responsibility on the state to uphold certain cultural prime values in Germany. However, this does not mean that the Constitution is open to a competition between different cultural systems with open results. Prohibited are cultural activities that engage in behaviors which contravene the criminal code and are directed against the constitutional order and the concepts of international understanding. The realization of the identity of the constitutional state rather than of a particular culture is what is aimed for. A framework that balances differences, ideas, ideologies, and religious and non-religious worldviews under a constitutional court which acts as umpire when called upon and which protects the core fundamental principles of the Constitution and the legal system. I will now come to the last part of my presentation, a review of the Islamic headscarf case. It will show how the constitutional concept and its main principles of parity, non-identification, and neutrality, which grew historically in relation to Christianity, are applied to balance the inner societal differences which occur within today's pluralist population. The headscarf case is to be viewed against this background. The fabric of the German population is roughly comprised of two-thirds belonging to the two major churches, the Catholic and the Protestant churches, but only about half of those actually describe themselves as religious. And this part is growing. They reject the dogmas of the confessional faith and prefer an individual, patchwork kind of private faith, but their value system is not much different from those connected to organized Christian religion. As committed members to the European Union, the Union's representative values of human rights, democracy, and peace are decisive in equal measures to the German population. 52% regard peace as most important, while religion is only for 7% of relevance, and only 3% understand religion as a representative value for the European Union. 3.9%, almost 4% of the German population are faithful and secular Muslims, and 1.7% belong to other religions or Christian confessions. The Islamic headscarf, worn in the general public or by students in public schools, is not subject to dress rules and therefore within the unlimited basic right to adhere to religious dogma and to express one's religious faith. But an Islamic headscarf worn by a teacher during official business within the special status relation of a public school setting involves a row of rights and duties which stand in particular tension to each other. There's the mandate of the state for providing an education while observing its non-identification and neutrality. There's the parents' basic right to the absence of influencing religious conduct and their right to decide about the religious upbringing of their children. And there's the student's duty to attend classes and the right of the teacher to individual religious freedom. As civil servants, public school teachers are representing the democratic constitutional state, including its inherent principles. The Constitution demands of the state to recognize the relevance of religion and at the same time not to make a particular religion the measure of public school education. In this balancing act, particular behavioral limits are attributed to its representative, the teacher. But those limits, in turn, need to be balanced with the individual teacher's right to freedom of religion, including the right to live her life according to the principles and dogmas of her religion. The Constitutional Court decided in 2003 that as long as no particular dress regulations exist in the Provincial School Act, the visibility of the teacher's religious conviction in itself is not unconstitutional and does not violate the neutrality principle, which representatives of the state are required to observe, because the interpretation of the meaning of the Islamic headscarf is objectively ambiguous. The headscarf can be a tool to further understanding between two cultures and can protect the person wearing it from loss of identity. Worn by a person who may have, in opposition to her culture of origin, obtained a profession and thus the possibility of independent existence, it may be a sign of emancipation instead of a sign of oppression and subjugation. Thus, the presence of an Islamic headscarf becomes an unduly influence only in connection with an overall disputable behavior of the person wearing it. In the particular case brought before the Constitutional Court, attempts by the teacher to religiously influence the pupils were not presented, nor was the teacher's loyalty to the Constitution disputed. Therefore, only her personal job qualifications, which, in according to the Constitution, is to be regarded independent of her religious or worldview confession, was to be considered. But it was also an undisputed given, so she was definitely qualified. Consequently, the headscarf-wearing teacher was admitted to civil service in public schools. The subsequent public debate was rich in polemics and mostly in total ignorance to the facts and particularities of the case. The arguments are based mainly on one-sided interpretations of the Islamic headscarf as a fundamentalist display of female subjugation and oppression in violation of the basic right of gender equality. The legislative response of the mainly Catholic southern German province involved in the case was the polemically called Anti-Headscarf Act. although it refers only in general to all kinds of religious dress and conduct rules for all teachers. And in Berlin, which has the large conservative Orthodox Muslim population of Turkish origin, now decisively more students attend public schools wearing headscarves, even at a young age at which Islam does not require covering the hair. The adherence to wearing the headscarf is checked on, even within the school settings. So this does fuel the fundamentalist interpretation of the headscarf. Mm-hmm. Interesting in the public discussion, also observable mainly in southern Catholic southern Germany, is also the treatment of the Islamic headscarf in comparison to the Christian crucifix. While the state-implemented crucifix in public schools is supposedly not in conflict with the state neutrality, the headscarf worn by an individual seems to always contravene the neutrality demand. This debate refers to the 1995 crucifix decision of the Constitutional Court, but mainly ignores the reasons and particularities of that case. The court had ruled that the provision of the Bavarian School Act, which made the display of the crucifix in every public classroom mandatory, was unconstitutional, and therefore the crucifixes had to be removed. Well, the court balances, actually correctly, the state's duty to protect the students from infringements of the basic right of religious freedom with the parents' right to religious choice for their children. By removing the crucifix, the state could remain religiously uncommitted and neutral without reducing or infringing the pupils' and parents' individual rights. The Constitutional Court's crucifix and headscarf decisions also stand in a correct relation to each other, as both observe the demanded non-identification and non-commitment of the state. Crucifixes are, in the Occidental context, the main religious symbol for Christianity and are capable of influencing the individual's freedom of religion when used in one-sided, state-ordered acts. Removing the wall crucifixes from public classrooms does not deprive faithful Christians from living their lives according to Christian dogma. But to demand the removal of an individually worn Islamic headscarf, although no doubt as to the wearer's loyalty to the Constitution and state laws is warranted, would deprive her from living according to Islamic dogma. Despite the balancing umpire decisions of the Constitutional Court, the public debate demonstrates a need for continuous efforts in cultural understanding. Distrust and misunderstandings are rooted in a century-old animosity against the rather symbolic Turk, an understanding which developed in the 15th century in reaction to the military expansion of the Islamic Turkish Ottoman Empire into Christian Central Europe, and which triggered global consequences. So where the voyages of discovery meant to find Christians and spices in an attempt to end the dependency on Muslim traders, but instead they came across the American continent. In Central Europe, it initiated an identity of a spiritually united Christianity in diametrical opposition to an Islamic Turkey. The Turkish Ottomans, appearing as monolithic and authoritative power system, seemed to confront the Holy Roman Empire and Latin European Christianity in its own organizational splintered weakness. As the Ottoman Empire was in cultural areas like medicine, mathematics and architecture far superior, a strong dichotomy could only be developed in the religious sphere by describing the faith enemy from the East as Antichrist, who achieved its power only through a diabolic and heretic disparagement of Christian teachings. This enemy perception of the other as derivation of the self was based on emotions of fascination and fear, of attraction and aversion. The image of a Turkish danger was subsequently popularized with the help of flyers printed on the newly invented printing press, and also fueled the perceptions and rhetoric within the confessional differences of the 16th century. Then Catholics saw the Protestants as Turkenizing Christianity, and the Lutherans denounced the Catholic observance of rites as Turkism. To dismantle the today mostly subliminal and unconscious negative residues from the Middle Ages, as well as dichotomous cultural closed system thinking in Christian, Islamic and German-Turkish relations, the German state sponsors meeting opportunities and educational projects ranging from youth centers to annual academic Islamic conferences. The first Islamic university faculty has been introduced, and Islamic religious instructions in public schools are accommodated, even in absence of a cooperative curriculum agreement with Muslim representatives in Germany. To prevent the many Muslim youth of Turkish heritage in Germany to become to become estranged from their religious heritage, a curriculum developed by the Turkish State Ministry for Religious Matters is used. This, though, stands a problematic contradiction to the Islamic self-evident truth of open multitude in regards to Muslims from other countries, and encounters questions concerning political influence opportunities for conservative Orthodox Turkish imams within Germany, as we have seen in the public school setting in Berlin. At the same time, some Islamic organizations inside Germany engage in trust-building initiatives like the Basic Declaration of the 2002 Islamic Charta. In reaction to the events of 9/11, it confesses that German Muslims are supportive of the achievements of the constitutional state, including the separation of church and state, and the freedom of religion for all religions. It is generally hoped that this challenge to fundamentalist Islamist movements might be the beginning of new Islam. In conclusion, I come to the end. The process of emancipation of the worldly order and the religious order from authoritarian structures characterizes the 19th century as having wrestled with a kind of Christianism, while the 20th century fought with nationalism. It is the task of the 21st century and beyond to overcome historic reciprocal animosities, mistrusts, suspicions, and closed cultural system thinking, and to instead find and promote peaceful, mutual common grounds and new relational peace frameworks for the emancipated individual and its societal organizations. This cannot be achieved with constitutional, intergovernmental, or supranational systems alone, or by legal coercion and authoritative orders without giving up on individual liberty. Internal state coherence and peace cannot be found in abstract systems, values, and ideas like religion and nation, but only in the inner substance of every emancipated individual. It is here that all faith can contribute religiously grounded motivations to the public realm for the purpose of supporting a stable foundation for and the protection of the constitutional liberal democratic state. In return, the state protects not only the individual, but also the corporate institutional form of freedom of religion. This is not the re-establishment of the Christian state or any other religious state, but the acknowledgement of public theology, because, to say it in the words of the retired German constitutional judge Bertram Furter, because the liberal state, the liberal secular state, lives off prerogatives which in itself cannot guarantee. This is the great risk it accepts in return for freedom.
Thank you. I think you can probably field the questions yourself. We have about 20 minutes or so, so feel free to talk.
I was interested by your comments about the German constitution in terms of what happens when there's a conflict with the criminal code. So, as far as I understood you, whenever there's a conflict with the criminal code trumps religious freedom. Is that correct?
No, it's not correct. Yeah. Well, every individual and organization has to respect the criminal code. So there's always it's a whole balancing system. There's always the balance to be found between the freedom of religion, which is separately guaranteed and has a special protection, and the criminal code. The criminal code doesn't prohibit any religious activities. If that was it, well, if the criminal code would prohibit religious activities, then the criminal code itself would be against the basic guaranteed rights. So, but none of the criminal code paragraphs prohibit any religious activities. It is like hate speech, things like this, like speech against other religious groups, like particular Jewish groups, that is what is prohibited. But it has to be hate speech, and this is why the Constitutional Court is there, to find the balance and decide what is it and where are the limits and what is permitted and what is not. So it's not not such an obvious, easy answer that can be given. Not any behavior that is against the criminal code is immediately something against the religious freedom.
But what would happen when there was, for example, polygamy?
Pardon?
What, for example, polygamy where it contravenes a criminal thing, which would be...
that's a Canadian question right now.
It's also in German because of the Turkish groups. Very often they say the right to four wives is a religious right.
Yes, so far it hasn't been decided. So there might be a case already in front of the court system, and the cases always have to go through all the system before it reaches the constitutional court. The same thing, it has to be evaluated. How far can a state go in prescribing what the individual under the religious dogmas can do or not? What does the state permit? But I think with this one, there are quite a few basic rights concerned, like the basic right of equality, which is one of gender equality, which is a special paragraph and rights also in that special catalog and particularly protected at the beginning. So there you have discussed two specially protected rights, and that is always a particular difficult way of deciding. I don't want to say what the Constitutional Court might do.
And the Muslims that I know in Germany, if you have married the women prior to entering Germany, prior to immigrating to Germany, they allow you to keep those wives, but you can't marry more wives while in Germany.
But there would be pension questions and all sorts of things that come up.
Yeah, it is. But also the... marriage in Germany is a civil wedding. You can marry. Religious marriages are not automatically, like here, acknowledged. It's a civil wedding.
But aren't marriages from other countries acknowledged by treaty?
They are.
About 25 years ago or so, I was studying Germany studying German in southern Germany. And one evening, a group of us, all foreigners, of course, went to a local pub, I guess, for an evening out. And while we were there, a person, obviously a local German person, got up and recited a fairly long, humorous poem. Now, my German wasn't so great, but I got enough of it to realize that this poem was actually a diatribe against Turkish immigrants. And complaining about these people going Jede Woche, Neue Brillen, and things like this. So I gathered, now we didn't particularly appreciate that, so we got up to leave, but then someone came and said, but we don't mean you, you know, because we're all sort of from the West. But so I wondered first whether there was a fair, or there could have been at that time, maybe a fairly widespread suspicion that the Gastarbeiter were coming in and with large families and were somehow draining the monies of the German state, or perhaps things have substantially changed by now.
Things like this and bad people are everywhere.
This is one of those
bad examples, yeah, and they make particular for Germany, they give a bad reputation with the history we've had. Yeah. So it is probably just the same like with other countries where people immigrate. It's during a spell where there is a high unemployment rate, the people that are already there are always scared, or any other reason, but it's not particularly against a special group. I think that the Turkish came up was the reason what I was citing here, the rather symbolic Turk. Yeah, that is that influence that is still left over from earlier ages. Yeah.
I understand that there is state support for financial support of Catholic and Lutheran church denominations in building churches in there, and the salary of the pastors and priests. Right? Does that extend then to the newer fundamental Christian, like Baptists?
Anyone is open. Any religious institution.
So Muslim.
Can apply for the public law status. It has to be assessed whether they are eligible for it according to worldly behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not their faith. Not according, their faith is not even supposed to come up. With the Catholic and the Protestant churches, it's a little bit different because they never have to apply for it.
Okay, got it.
This is because of their history,
right.
Because of their religious developments during the last few centuries. It's left over from there.
But by Protestant, you mean specifically
the evangelical church.
So I guess my question is, have the other Protestant, what we consider in Canada, other Protestant churches,
Baptists or whatever,
and perhaps Jewish or Muslim, receive that kind of stuff?
Here's a list of all the ones that get support. So it's quite a few.
Just in case you want to ask that question.
Well, yeah, I knew it would count.
Part of the tension that I hear from my family in Germany is that there is a growing Baptist and Pentecostal
movement.
And they do still have what's considered in Canada a common thing where it's totally fundraised through the membership of the community, and they don't get state funding.
Yeah, but it's up to them to apply for it or not.
Okay.
And like the Hindu and the Buddhism organizations, they have not applied for it, and they just openly said, we are not going to apply for it, we do it differently.
It's
by their choice.
It does not include any Muslim or...
No, the Muslims have not yet been accepted. There's one particular reason, because they haven't got any organization yet that can speak for all the Muslims in Germany, but they are in the process of developing this kind of organization. So far, even if certain Muslim groups would apply for it, the membership between those groups is fluent.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really decide who is who. And then with the fundamentalist and Islamist movements of or ideas of some, the state can't support groups that have it written or in their mind to destroy the state.
Yeah.
So you, right now the Islamic organizations are trying to get an overall organizational structure
mm-hmm.
built, and then this group will not have any problems of getting the same status.
In the old days, it used to be financed using the Kirchensteuer. Then later on it became possible to opt out, or it was possible all along to opt out of the Kirchensteuer. What is the situation right now? I haven't paid attention.
It's exactly the same. Hasn't changed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And more and more have opted out. Right? So that's,
But that also means they left the churches.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I have a question about how the German government decides what a cult is. The famous example right now is, of course, Tom Cruise and the movie Valkyrie, because it was such a controversy because he was not allowed to work and do this movie because of his Scientology background. And I was wondering, I had never heard this before, and I read it in a number of German newspapers. It was in Berlin that they refused him the right to work because Scientology is considered a cult. And I'm not debating that or anything, but I had never heard of this before.
So who decides that? Is that the question?
I
haven't heard of it.
Oh, okay.
And there must have been something additionally. It probably didn't have to do with religion. Must have been I can only explain.
Well, these are articles that I read, and that's why I was so surprised by it.
Yeah, but when the Scientology wasn't recognized as a religious society in Germany, there was a huge outcry here. But it had a... God, I wish I could remember. It had a very particular reason, and it had to do with a financial base. Like, to become a member in the Scientology denomination group, or whatever you want to call it, it's... I understand you have to kind of submit all your financial means to the group, and they make the final decisions. So this stands in particular attention to the basic right of property, Article 14. Mm-hmm. And there had to be made a decision about this. Is that maybe not really the way, well, their financial regulations, is that really... still covered by religious freedom, or is it maybe that religious freedom is only a cover up for the financial opportunities or they want? So, and so that Tom Cruise wasn't permitted to work there, it might have been because he advertised for a group that wasn't permitted for, wasn't recognized or something like this, or permitted to be,
yeah.
I don't know.
It was
I haven't heard of it.
Let's see if I'll find the articles again. Apparently, he no longer gets advertisements.
Any more questions?
I thought it was very interesting. I appreciated your talking about the culture of the battle during the 18th century, and how that spilled over to broader theological questions. So it's a question of whether the Pope had the right to say who taught theology in university or the state and that kind of thing, and the compromise that it came to still has its effect in the theological aspect of our churches.
Well, the Kulturkampf was way more complicated and complex than this, because it also was against the social democrats on the other side.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is why we have that social security system now, because Bismarck introduced that social security system because that was the demand of the Socialist Democratic Party, and he wanted to get rid of them by doing what they wanted. That was their only demand. They thought they would disappear, and when he does that, they didn't disappear. Just like the Catholic Center Party didn't disappear.
If I can give John a simple explanation, many years ago I was introduced to German history here by... an old professor who remembered Bismarck, and his theory was that in 1875 Bismarck had particularly bad attacks of the gout, and that's what made it. There is something to it.
Any other questions or comments?
I guess I want to follow up a little bit on Paul's question. It has a broader implication than how does Germany wrestle with what we Canadians also wrestle with, some religious practices that may by others can be considered abuses, like female circumcision, even male circumcision in Jewish traditions, recognizing gay rights, that kind of thing.
Well, that is internally, that's a faith question. So the German state is neutral, isn't supposed to interfere into the faith question. It only becomes a matter
when you take it outside of faith,
when you
abuse of
in
a child,
employment contract, for example, then it might become a problem, but only in certain employments, because if the church itself, for its own administration, for example, employs someone puts into the contract that you are not supposed to live in a gay or bisexual or whatever situation, then it's totally up to the church, you know, that the state is not interfering there at all. But if it is like a old age facility, which is run by the church, but it is in a public legal setting, so then the regular employment laws apply. But it is still a gray area. It's not 100% clear.
We're also wrestling with age of consent, sexual consent for children. You know, depending on which cultural background you come from, or religious background, someone raise it or lower it. Does that come up with in Germany?
Well, the only way it can come up within the court system is if someone complains and says, I'm injured in my basic rights of self-determination and so on and so on. Yeah, then the state can answer to that. Yeah. But if it's done and accepted by females within their faith beliefs and faith setting and never complain to the state cannot interfere. Yeah.
So there isn't a legal age of consent?
There is. But only, it's the same thing, like, if nobody knows, So only if it becomes known that it was violated. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So obviously they wouldn't seek a civil marriage, but they could have, within their religious community, they could...
But then they would never be considered
legally married, of course.
But then that is a pension problem, a social security problem, tax problem. You pay way more taxes if you're not married. Yeah, things like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But having a wife of 12 years old would be a problem, would it not?
It would be if it gets known. Oh yes, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. Because it also becomes the child abuse issue.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah, for sure.
So how would it become known? I mean, somebody would denounce them, or what's the...
If somebody tells the prosecutor's office, for example, or if the child itself goes to the police, for example, or tells someone and someone goes to the police, then as soon as it comes known to the prosecutor's office,
they have to act.
Okay. Yeah. Even if they say that 10 years later, or...
Oh, that's a very specific question. I would have to look into the paper.
But we do...
If it happened in childhood and then matured and came to their ability to be able to confront...
Probably it would go under a different paragraph of just interference with your bodily... self-determination. Yeah.
By Canadian law, we have, it's an obligation of teachers to disclose that if they
sure, that is one way of finding out.
So there's an obligation of both parts. It's not sort of pretending to be blind. If you do have knowledge in any sort of fashion, even if it's not a declaration by the individual, it's an obligation by the professional to legally.
That's through the child service then. They have to report to the child service. The child service then informs the prosecutor's office if they find something to it.
We can have more conversations over cookies and juice, those who have time, but those who have to rush to other classes, appointments, or snowball fights, we should be able to release them. So we want to thank Carola for a brilliant way of giving us an overview. I just love to get a bit of a historical perspective, because you just hear the case and you just hear the media report, and often we do not actually know, okay, well, legally, I'm sure I know the Grundrecht or whatever, the basic law, and you know, whatever. And the interesting thing is Germany has a constitutional court, which we do not have.
Yeah.
Right? So that in itself twists things or changes things about how decisions are made around some of these issues. But thank you, Carola. It was lovely to have you here and carry on with conversations.